Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schleter, Judge Werke, Judge Shellhouse, the Honorable Randall J. Schleter presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome, counsel, and to others in the courtroom. We have five matters for oral hearing this morning, Court of Appeals. The first matter is file A18-1081, Allison Joel Peterson, respondent versus Western National Mutual Insurance Company. And as counsel is aware, of course, each party will be allowed 15 minutes, 5 minutes for appellant to respond if you so choose. When you do approach the podium, we do ask that you identify yourself for the record. If you need to adjust the podium, feel free to do that. And when you're ready to proceed, appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Bjorkman, and I represent the appellant Western National Mutual Insurance Company. This appeal involves the application of Minnesota's first-party bad faith statute and arises from an underlying underinsured motorist claim. As this court undoubtedly knows, to prevail on a claim under the statute, a claimant must show two things. Number one, the absence of a reasonable basis for the insurer to dispute the claim, and number two, that the insurer knew it had no reasonable basis to dispute the claim or acted in reckless disregard as to whether a reasonable basis existed.
Doesn't, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I heard you just say, did you say or and?
It's an and.
Okay.
Both elements need to be proven.
All right.
And if the first element, reasonable basis, isn't proven, the court need not get to the second element. Here, the district court concluded Western National violated the statute and violated both elements. We respectfully submit that the district court misapplied the statute by weighing the competing evidence with respect to the merits of the underlying UIM claim rather than acknowledging the existence of that evidence, which made Western National's dispute concerning the claim reasonable as a matter of law. At the end of the day, this error requires reversal regardless of what standard of review this court applies. I'd like to focus.
Mr. Buffren, can I just inquire, when you say misapplied the statute, is that by virtue of the court seemingly to have accepted the Wisconsin case law in terms of a similar statute? By that I mean the statute itself. Did the court need to go outside of the statute at all in order to make the determination that it did? And if it had, what would be the error in the findings the court made? In other words, if you can parse out ones that might be related to some of the case law from Wisconsin versus just simply looking at our statute, since we don't have similar case law.
Sure, and I'm not sure the court had to go outside Minnesota to interpret the statute. I think the statute's clear. I think our Supreme Court has said that. Having said that, however, the statute is modeled after very similar law in other jurisdictions, including Wisconsin. So I don't think there's anything wrong with the district court, for example, or this court, looking to some other jurisdictions for guidance in terms of how the statute applies.
May I ask you a question in regard to that? In looking at a treatise on a Minnesota insurance bad faith called DRI Insurance Bad Faith, and in looking at Minnesota practice, 22 Section 3750, I see the same statement, which is legislative history indicates this language, referring to the statute, is not intended to incorporate case law that interprets the so-called Anderson standard, the Wisconsin standard.
That is true. The legislative history does include that remark. However, the statute itself was modeled after other states that apply. Wisconsin, for example, applies a similar two-prong test. Iowa applies a similar two-prong test. So,
well, isn't this exactly contrary, though, to the district court's conclusion number two, that Minnesota's bad faith statute is modeled on the principles set forth in Anderson?
Well, I believe that. I think it is modeled after that.
After Anderson?
After the two-prong test there. However, as the court has known, the legislative history would include the statement that by adopting that two-part test, the court or the legislature was not expressly adopting how courts in Wisconsin have interpreted that statute. So it comes to it, to answer back to your question, you can look outside. We're not contending you can't look outside Minnesota for guidance, but at the end of the day, the function of the court is to look at the statute, decide what it says, and decide what the court's function is. And I think that's really the starting point for our position and for the court's analysis. And where the court got it wrong was if you look at the statute itself has a, in order to amend the complaint, a prima facie showing allows the submission of competing evidence. And so a prima facie showing, by definition, isn't a weighing of evidence. It's a determination of, is there competing evidence in the first instance? And if so, under subdivision 4, that means you don't even get to amend. So the statute itself indicates that it's the existence of competing evidence is what the court's function is in deciding whether the first prong has been set. And if that's true, then, of course, all the detailed findings of the district court here about credibility, about believability, about weight are moot, are incorrect, are errors that have no application to the determination of, was there a reasonable basis to begin with?
Mr. Bjorkman, if your client concedes then that the court may look outside, and Wisconsin in particular seems to be what the court focused on, is not part of what the Wisconsin analysis would be as to the similar prong, the reasonableness of the investigation into the claim, which does seem to get into what the trial court here was doing, is weighing not just the IMEs, but also a lack of perhaps further pursuant of the claim under a reasonable investigation standard.
Well, yeah, and that's a problematic because the investigation here would not have changed the result. At the end of the day, when all the IMEs were concluded, when all the evidence was finally obtained and reviewed, the position remained the same. And so that timing and an investigative piece doesn't fit within the context of this case. But where, for example, where case law from other jurisdictions might be instructive would be Iowa. The Supreme Court in Iowa, the Belleville case that we've provided the court, same test as Wisconsin, same test, two-prong test as Minnesota, and the court there has quite clearly said, on the reasonableness prong, the issue is that the court or the jury is to look to is, was there competing evidence? And if so, it was reasonable as a matter of law. You don't, it's not a weighing of the evidence. And so the statute supports that. The case law from other jurisdictions supports
that. Wouldn't
that
not be a distinction, though? It appears to me that Iowa has a much more perhaps limited analysis, given that what you just pointed out in the Belleville case in particular, that if there's evidence, which I assume here would simply be the IME as your client had, and therefore ends the discussion. But getting back to Wisconsin, it seems that approach is different. That's part of why I was interested in your thought. If Wisconsin's accepted and go into a fair investigation, once you have perhaps competing opinions, that would seem to, what then did you do after that to see what the distinctions are, what are the differences are? And I know in this case, the reference to a jury verdict in a similar scenario, that the district court seemed to convince that at least raised some investigative obligation under the Wisconsin standard, though it might not have under Iowa.
Well, and that's fine. Let's assume there was some additional obligation that the Butler verdict created on Western National. What we've laid out in our brief is the lawyer that represented the plaintiff in Butler was the defense counsel for Western National. There's nobody who knew better the facts of Butler, the similarities, the differences. That was all as laid out by the district court. He conveyed all of that information to Western National. They considered all of that information. They did post-IME investigation, if you want, and it still didn't change Mr. Martin, the lawyer's evaluation that there was a reasonable basis to dispute the claim, nor did it change Western National's view. So even if we want to disregard, that may be too strong a word, what the legislative history suggests and look outside Minnesota for guidance on what other courts are doing on similar circumstances, there's nothing there that would defeat, overcome that first prong. There was a reasonable basis to begin with. So we've got case law suggesting it's competing evidence. That's really what the function of the court is in looking at this. We've got the statute itself that says it's the case, it's the competing evidence. If there's competing evidence, hard stop, you don't amend the complaint. Minnesota hasn't directly addressed this specific issue, but there are several decisions from this court that certainly seem to imply the analysis is there competing evidence? And if so, no motion to amend or no bad faith. And the cases I'm thinking of in that regard are the Homestead Hills. Summary judgment for the insurer denied because of genuine issue of fact. Motion to amend add bad faith denied. The Swanee case, the Bernstrom case, all of those cases admittedly don't directly address the issue of are we looking for competing evidence or are we weighing it? But they certainly strongly imply that it's really not, we're not worried with the weighing that was done. What we're worried about under the statute is there a reasonable basis to dispute the claim in the first instance?
Perhaps getting back then to the absence, though, then of an adoption by our legislature, it would not be true, as respondents pointed out, the court has made pretty detailed findings, so it would be a Rule 52 deference to the court's findings, and the court clearly found it was not reasonable. On what affirmative basis, unless we were to accept either an Iowa analysis of don't weigh the evidence or a Wisconsin and then affirm under that basis, what affirmative basis separate from looking at the judge's findings would we have to say it was an error of law?
Well, and it would go back to the starting point. What's the starting point? What does absence of a reasonable basis mean? And what's the court's function in determining that? And again, the statute says you don't even get to amend. A prima facie showing includes the opposition submitting a counter affidavit, which is seemingly inconsistent with what most people think about in terms of what prima facie is. But that shows under the statute, in order to even amend to add the claim, you have to have no competing evidence to begin with. So again, the statute itself, don't look anywhere else, don't look at the Iowa law, says to make a prima facie showing to add the claim, you have to have no competing evidence. So we don't, again, I think you can look elsewhere. You don't need to look elsewhere. What is absence of...
Are you not conflating, though, this competing evidence? I mean, it seems to me that in this case, we decide whether the evidence existed for the examiner to deny the claim. We're not weighing the evidence.
Correct. And our criticism of the district court was the the findings clearly acknowledge the existence of the evidence, but the court found the other evidence was better, that or more believable, more credible. That that weighing was what was improper in the context of the statute, because it's the existence of the evidence in the first instance. And, you know, district courts are used to making those kind of determinations in other contexts all the time. We think of summary judgment. We think of directed verdict. We think of JNOV. Under those evidentiary contexts, the court looks if there is evidence, admissible evidence, upon which reasonable minds could differ, i.e., reasonableness right there. We let juries decide it. We judges don't weigh it. So that's the Dutton rule. I mean, that's the Dutton rule we've cited in our brief. The fact that the court here sent the merits of the UIM claim to the jury, there was no objection about any of the evidence. There was no effort to exclude any of the evidence Western National presented. There was no motion for a directed verdict. The court understood and recognized what happens on personal injury claims every day in Minnesota. There's a dispute about pre-existing conditions. There's a dispute about a cause of the injury. There's evidence on both sides. It's reasonable minds could differ. We're going to let a jury decide. So again, if that's what reasonable means, the beginning and the end of the bad faith inquiry should have been, we had to let a jury decide it. And I'd submit that's precisely why we have few cases in Minnesota that have ever even permitted the amendment to add a bad faith, and we've got even fewer cases in Minnesota that have ever allowed, found bad faith. And that brings me to my final point, and that is the respondent takes the position, well, geez, that's really harsh. That's a really narrow rule if it works that way. And that's precisely the point. It's a very limited remedy.
Well, it clearly places a quite a high bar.
It places a very high bar, and it does so on purpose. It's a limited remedy that applies in very limited circumstances, and those circumstances just aren't present here. The court made very detailed findings, but the court made the wrong findings. The issue was the existence of competing evidence, not the weight of the evidence. And it's that error, that review it de novo, call it a clear error, just misapplied the facts to the law. That requires reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Respondent, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Catherine Barrett Wick of Best and Flanagan, and I represent the respondent, Ms. Allison Peterson. This court should affirm the district court's conclusion that Western National Mutual Insurance Company acted in bad faith in violation of our state's first party bad faith statute when it refused to pay Ms. Peterson's underinsured motorist claim. This court reviews for clear error a district court's reasonableness analysis under Minnesota's bad faith statute. This court so found first in the Bernstrom decision in 2012 and then later in the Suwannee of Hugo decision. In both of those cases, in the standard of review portion of the decisions, the court held that whether an insurer lacked a reasonable basis for denying a claim such as Ms. Peterson's was a factual issue, just as questions of reasonableness generally are fact issues. And therefore, this key issue before Your Honors today is one that you review for clear error.
Ms. Wick, and I'll just jump right in on that point, as Mr. Bjorkman was pointing out. Would not, just literally looking at the statute, since that's really our primary, if not sole, guidance in this case, at least for, at the appellate level. Would it not be reasonable that an IME is presented? So unless there's, while there might be a weight difference in a trial, which I'm assuming that was part of the presentation at the UIM trial itself for purposes of bad faith, would that not just generally take it out of bad faith right there? In other words, that's reasonable, that those reasonable minds, those two experts differed, end of story?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the legislature required a reasonable basis. And so I would disagree with my esteemed colleague here that there isn't, in this procedural moment, at least for the district court, there isn't a weighing, because it doesn't say any evidence. Mr. Bjorkman used the phrase several times, existence of competing evidence. It is not the existence of any competing evidence. It's the existence of reasonable evidence. And that is exactly in this moment when deciding the merits of a bad faith claim, what a district court has to do. Look at the evidence put forth that was before the insurer at the various times when it chose to deny the claim, at least in this factual history, and determine whether that was reasonable evidence. So I don't think, respectively, Your Honor, that that it's any evidence. You know, if you have an IME such as you have here, where the insurance company chose to hire an expert who really, frankly, was not an expert at the key concern to the insurance company, which was using Botox to treat chronic headaches. Their expert had no expertise in that. He didn't done that in his practice. He didn't have that. And so that's not a reasonable competing IME. And that was what the district court found. And that finding is entitled to deference.
What case law would we look to for the proposition that we should consider what evidence is reasonable or not?
I think Bernstrom is instructive. So I mentioned that for the standard of review. Bernstrom was a case where it also, the procedural history of Bernstrom, frankly, cuts against the interpretation of the statute that my colleague is suggesting. So Bernstrom was a case where it was a car accident. There was found to be a fact issue on the underlying UIM claim, so it went to the jury. And after that, the district court was deciding the post-verdict proceeding on bad faith, and the district court looked at the expert testimony. So this really ties into Judge Sleater's, your question, too. In that instance, there was evidence that the same injury that was being complained of, that the plaintiff had that injury before, that she had a degenerative spine, I think it was rheumatoid arthritis or degenerative arthritis, and that, in fact, there was evidence that she might have needed the very same treatment that she ultimately needed as a result, in her mind, of the accident, that she might have needed that same treatment anyway because of her pre-existing condition. So in that case, the court recognized in that weighing and in that analysis that there was a reason to doubt causation, and that was fairly debatable. And we simply have no evidence of that here. If we look at the moment of the pretty devastating analysis, of facts from when their Ms. Helmer, their adjuster, all of the experts, treaters, all of that evidence was presented to the insurance company in 2014 when the demand letter was made. So we had Dr. Senkakova, we had the second opinion from Dr. Schreifer, and we had the chiropractic evidence. So all of that evidence was put forth before the insurer, and the insurer at that point had no basis for denying it. And I also just want to push back respectfully on, there was a statement made by my colleague that when they finally obtained and reviewed records, and that just simply is not supported by the evidence. They had that evidence. They had the records. And you know what? They also had an authorization. So if they wanted second copies of the records that they already had, they could have gotten them right away. So there was no finally. Ms. Peterson's counsel, from the moment that this UMI claim was tendered, had everything in front of this insurance company that they needed to do the right thing and provide the benefits.
Why didn't the UIM issue get tried sooner than it did?
Well, I think the UIM issue was tried. I mean in relation to when the injury happened?
Well, the UIM was tried over this, all this conduct with respect to records versus not having records, consideration of the records, consideration of the cause of the headaches and the extent of the headaches and the remedy for the headaches. Correct?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you asking about timing or?
Yes.
So the underlying UMI trial, I mean, I think the defendant tried to argue that there was an alternative cause, but they didn't have evidence to support that, because the theory put forth by their expert was that there was a psychiatric cause, but there was no underlying psychiatric diagnosis. And so that evidence, as I understand the record, the case proceeded to the UIM trial, you know, certainly in a reasonable track, and that evidence was put forth before the jury when they were, you know, evaluating essentially the contract claim, and they found it uncompelling because it wasn't evidence that frankly provided another reasonable cause. And that was also important to the district court when looking, when paying deference or being respectful of the jury's, the conclusions we can glean from the jury's verdict. When looking at the evidence, the district court said this was not fairly debatable. In these proceedings, the insurer says that it's fairly debatable, but they didn't debate it. They just didn't want to believe the unrefuted evidence in front of them, and they wanted to stall, and they did. And when they ultimately, after she sued them, decided they needed to have an IME, they chose someone who wasn't an expert in this area and who, frankly, came forth with a conclusion that I'm not sure would pass the Fry-Mac standard, because it was this idea that she had a psychiatric problem, but there was no psychiatric diagnosis, and he didn't ask for one. He wasn't capable of doing one. So there was really no basis for that.
Is the strength of your argument that it was not fairly debatable what caused your client's headaches or what the remedy for your client's headaches was?
I think the fairly debatable analysis, which Minnesota courts have borrowed in interpreting our bad faith statute, looks at whether the accident about which the UMI coverage might apply, I think it's both. Whether there was any reason to fairly debate, you know, I think if an insurer had reasonable evidence to debate one or the other, that might give them a basis for disputing it. But here they had neither. So they didn't have any evidence to suggest that the cause was at issue, because unlike in Bernstrom, where the individual's complaints about how she was injured from the accident directly mapped onto some of her prior health conditions, Ms. Peterson didn't have that. She had sort of everyday tension headaches that, you know, those of us who are lucky not to struggle with, you know, serious headaches, we might need to take an Advil. That's what she had before. And afterwards, she had these horrible headaches that debilitated her and that happened every day. So there was no reasonable dispute as to cause.
Maybe getting right to that, the heart of that, is that not, I'm assuming it was the same IME that testified on behalf of the defense appellant at trial, and so that would have been the cross-examination and poke holes into the IME. But wouldn't it be safe or more proper to say the court, for that, the jury, I should say, found that cross-examination compelling and therefore discounted that doctor's opinion versus the plaintiff appellant's opinion, but that would not, as a matter of law, make that doctor's opinion unreasonable. Simply, they gave more weight to one doctor over another doctor, hence the verdict. And so what I'm getting at, and even that IME's opinion here, wasn't the Botox really irrelevant to the issue, that the primary issue that doctor was giving the opinion that it was not caused, her symptoms were not caused by this accident, hence the position that zero or maybe up to 50,000, I think, was one of the offers ultimately made. But wouldn't that put it in the realm of reasonable, though reasonable minds can differ, and a jury differed from that IME? That's your standard UIM trial.
Well, I think that might suggest why the statutory scheme is not set up the way that Mr. Berkman suggests that he would like it to be, because there might be a jury issue, and yet that means that the insured is not entitled to judgment as a matter of law. But then in looking at the bad faith issue, I don't know how, I guess I'm trying to answer your question in a way that's the most consistent with the language of the statute itself. I don't know how a judge can decide whether there was an absence of a reasonable basis without doing that weighing, both for the first prong and the second prong. That is the method through which a district court judge would make such a decision, would evaluate the credibility of the fact witnesses, the expert witnesses, you know, analyze the documents that were in front of the insurer, you know, all along the time that they continued to deny the claim.
So do you believe that statutory language would obligate a similar situated defendants to get a second or third or require continually examining the IME or doctors or some situation I assume that doesn't regularly occur here that just formulates the party's positions in a typical UIM case like this, and then they negotiate from
there. Well, I think, so the expert, plaintiff's expert, insurance expert, Mr. Danis, I think provides some sense of what the, you know, this, you know, it's not exactly standard of care, but what the industry standard is. So I think it's going to be very fact-specific. In some instances, there might be the reason, and we see, I think, was it Bernstrom, there was two IMEs. There may be instances where a second IME is required if the insurer wants to continue to deny the claim. In this case, there was just such an overwhelming, respectfully, Your Honors, this is not a close case. There was just overwhelming evidence as to what caused Ms. Peterson's chronic headache injury, as to what was needed for her to try to live day to day with this injury, about the fact that it came from the car accident, and about the fact that they should have been a notice because their own lawyer had obtained a Botox verdict in excess of $1 million for, I understand that, and clearly he chose in speaking with
this. What do you mean by a Botox verdict?
Well, so the Butler case.
I'm familiar. I mean, I've read the record.
Yeah.
But why would you, is this what you're calling this case, a Botox case?
Well, that's the treatment for her. That's why they didn't want to pay it, because they were concerned about the extreme costs related to treating headaches with Botox. And so that is, so my point in calling it that is a factually indistinguishable case in the same fora, right on the eve of trial, where there was a very real risk to the insurer that these arguments could fail and that there could be a recovery that well exceeded $250,000, which was the policy limits. And so I think the district court was right to look at that as just another, not just another, because it's such an important fact, but another fact that the insurer just continued to disregard in addition. I mean, that's not necessary. This was bad faith without that. But the fact that they had sort of this other moment right before their own trial in this case to say, listen, have we been viewing this right? We think
okay,
that this is...
Okay, I'm just going to interrupt you because I know your time is short.
Yeah.
Here's what I'd like you to try to help me with.
Sure.
Having presided over many cases involving injuries as a district court judge, caused by accidents. In every one of those cases, there were dueling experts about the issue of what caused the low back pain or the upper back pain or the headaches or the neck pain. What makes this case different than any of those cases, leaving out the word Botox?
I think the fact that there was no evidence in the record that she had had any similar injury before, so there was no,
she'd had some tension headaches before.
But she had she didn't have this underlying, the injuries for which she was seeking recovery. She had not experienced that before. And there was no dispute as to essentially what treatment was required to provide her at least the 50% relief. So, I think there was a very strong underlying case, and there was a choice by the defendant to use experts that frankly didn't directly respond to some of those key causation and damages elements.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
The court has nothing further. Thank you.
Mr. Bjarkman, you may respond if you wish.
Yes, very briefly.
I think this was a standard personal injury UIM case. I mean, listening to the argument here, it sounds a little bit like re-arguing or cross-examining the doctor, re-arguing the closing argument at the UIM trial. I heard Fry Mac. It sounds like we're going to have an evidentiary hearing to exclude expert testimony. Well, all of that that was the UIM trial. I mean, and it was more, it's the standard case. Prior car accidents, no objective findings, less than limit settlements. IME doctors. They didn't even need an IME doctor. You can go try a personal injury case and cross-examine the opposing doctor, and if the jury believes the doctor's wrong, win. So to say there was no reasonable basis, there certainly was, or there wouldn't have been a trial. The district court here, having the benefit or being tainted by what happened with the jury, it's not a reweighing of the evidence. Was there competing evidence upon which reasonable minds could differ as to the merits in the first instance? And if so, it can't be bad faith. That's what the statute says. That's what case law around the country interpreting similar requirements says. And so the district court just made an error of law and requires reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the briefing and comments of counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion. Have a good day.
Oh, may I ask one question?
Sure. I'm sorry. Counsel, if you want to remain just a moment.
Oh, counsel for respondent, you said you're Bess and Flanagan?
Yes.
But the brief says Robbins Kaplan. Has something been filed with the court explaining?
Sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
So in a case like this where I remain on the case, I believe we filed sort of like a change of firm affiliation. But I was still with Robbins at the time we filed the briefs, and I moved just about a month.
So when we issue an opinion, we will note that you're Robbins Kaplan?
Bess and Flanagan now.
Now. Does that require a substitution of counsel?
I think that we filed that, changed my EMAX affiliation.
Oh,
and
okay.
So I believe it may just not have made its way
to you. Okay, it just didn't trickle down to me. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Okay. We'll make a note of that.
Thank you.
Have a good day.